This is Ralph Bolsted, and we're talking about the ear and its problems today. I made this diagram of the ear. I was asked about, what kind of a rocket I was diagramming up here. It does look sort of like a neat rocket, doesn't it? Take off and count. I tried to make it symbolic, shall we say, of the things which happen. First you have a funnel, the ear. And this outer part of the ear is rather important. If you want to hear about twice as well, in fact, if you're talking loud and you put your ears up, your hands up to your ears, it's sort of shocking to hear. Certain values, higher pitches, for instance, are amplified as you put your hand up. And you can hear that these outer ears actually do something for you. Of course, you know, a rabbit that has to hear the enemy coming up on him has very long ears. You come through a canal, you come to a diaphragm, the drum, the eardrum, and it's here that the air movement is changed into mechanical movement of bones. There are three bones in there, tiny bones. And they have fanciful names like stirrup and hammer and anvil, I believe, if I remember rightly. And this system of bones does amplify the sounds, bring them in much better. Then they come, the sound, mechanical sound then, or movement, it's not sound at that point, technically, it's movement of these bones, moves another diaphragm back here in the inner ear, where there is a large band, that's the easiest way to think about it, on which there are a bunch of hair, the organ of corticalis, this is called, and the hairs seem to vibrate according to the pitch. And of course at the base of every hair there is some kind of a nerve connection. It's still not exactly, you know what must happen, but you can't exactly follow all that happens in the ear yet. But this organ changes the mechanical, and this is filled with fluid by the way, changes that mechanical action of the bones to movement of the fluid, which changes these hairs on the organ of corti, which changes the movement into sensations. Just like when you touch your hand, you're changing pressure, feeling of pressure, into nerve sensations. And then you interpret it again, and your brain is being pressure. But of course, there isn't pressure that runs up to your brain from your hand. There's just nerve impulses. In the same way in your brain, it isn't from your ear. It isn't sound that goes from your ear to your brain. It's these nerve impulses by way of the eighth nerve. The eighth nerve is all within the skull. In fact, this fancy picture there is bone. If you reach behind your ear, you can feel that the bone comes out. There isn't much fat or meat, skin, good heavy skin over it, but that's the bone that surrounds the ear. And sort of interesting, the bone around the ear in this area is some of the hardest bone we have, and when if you're buried intact. A thousand years from now, you may not have anything else left of your skull except those bones. Those bones tend to be the hardest that's left. You find in the ocean depths, you often find this little inner ear part, because that's the hardest bone in the body. Why it should be, I really don't know, but it's interesting. Then we have the semicircular canals. Any of you acquainted with semicircular canals? Any of you have any trouble with them or anything? Any of you acquainted with the carpenter's level, the bubbles in the carpenter's level? Well, these are vaguely related to that. There are probably some little bones in here that will react to motion. That's one way you know where your head is. There are a number of places, a number of ways that you know where your head is, but that's one of them. Or, in particular, change of motion, you see. If this is interpreted by your brain, the signals that come up, you have a wonderful, what they call, servo mechanism, if this were in an airplane, for instance, to connect your movement with your eyes. Because as I move my head now, I still keep... You people aren't blurred. You know, you can move your head around, up and down, and it isn't blurred. You can keep looking at a person as you move. Part of that, there are, again, a lot of things that the brain understands, takes in from nerve endings all over, in your muscles, in your skin, in your neck, but also from the semicircular canals to correct your eye so that your eyes stay in the same place. You get in some trouble with that when you get dizzy. The reason that the world goes around when you're dizzy, well, let's say that I can remember as a child of, I suppose, six, someplace in there, of loving to run, you know, go in a circle until I would fall down, I'd look up, and the whole world would just keep going round and round. Now I'd be so sick just to look at the guy doing it that I couldn't make it. But that, what has happened is that you have overstimulated these semicircular canals. They go, continue to go after you stop, and the eyes are going, they'll go back, they can't go around and around, but they go around this way or back and forth. And then your brain says, I must be going around, or the earth must be going around. It isn't my eyes that are going around, you know, that's what your brain says. And so because of the way that these things are going, you can get dizzy, you can see the earth go around. In fact, if these are stimulated, somebody was saying they had Meniere's syndrome. One of the things that can happen, and there are several different types of Meniere's syndrome, but one of the things that can happen is that the nerves are stimulated here, whether it's from a virus that attacks it or what, but at least they're stimulated. And up at the brain says, those semicircular canals are going around. That means that you're going around or that the world is going around. And so if you barely move your head, well, it feels like everything is going around. We lost one thing here. The eustachian tube. Now, probably you all remember this anatomy well enough from your days of hygiene and what, seventh grade was it? There's a tube that leads from the inner ear, or the middle ear, I should say. This is the middle ear. The outer, middle, and inner ear with all the nerve mechanisms. leads from the middle ear to balance the air pressure on the two sides of your ear. Those of you that flew from Minneapolis, how many of you were? Okay. I'm sure you had to open this eustachian tube as you climbed and as you descended to be sure that you would get that middle ear balanced, I mean the pressure on the two sides balanced. It can be very painful if you don't. In fact, kids will scream sometimes when they come down because of the pressure put on this because the two sides aren't balanced. And the reason you have to swallow is that I haven't shown it here, but this is into the throat, there's muscles along here. Ordinarily that's closed, so you don't have free access. It isn't a nice big hole like I've shown you there. It has to be open, so when you swallow, you tend to stretch that and open it. That allows the air to go in and equalize it. There's one other thing that we can do that works even better than swallowing. Do you remember, any of you, what?
Chew gum
and yaw.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that. When we mention it, you'll all be yawning and saying how boring it is. So that's the general physiology and anatomy of it. I'm sure it's so clear to you now that you want to have trouble. Any questions on the anatomy of it, the physiology of it?
Is there also a connection, I suppose there is, but is there a connection to the eye through your throat also?
Not, yes and no. There's a drainage from your eye down into your nose. I'm sure there's a name for it, and I've forgotten it. The hole. It can be plugged. If it is plugged, then you tear a great deal, naturally, because the tears don't have a drain. It can also, you can have trouble if your eye everts, the lid everts, so that that is turns out. So the drain isn't down into the corner, so you keep tearing. That's one of the common things. But it isn't from inside the eye. Just as this really isn't from inside the ear. It's inside the middle ear, but not the hearing part of the ear. So it's very much like that. Only it doesn't help you to swallow, to open up that.
Yes? Well, one here is the expression that a sense of balance is in the ear. Is that accurate?
That's this.
That you're talking about, semicircular
canals. Semicircular canals.
Does that have anything to do with seasickness?
Very true. Have any of you been seasick?
Yes.
Boy, I'm one of those that can really get seasick. Have you found anything that helps you?
Dramamine.
That's an antihistamine, and most of them will work. Dramamine is one of the better ones. I guess there are some new ones now.
Pardon? Some newer medicine.
I think so, but I'm not acquainted with them.
I read that if you use some ginger, have you ever heard of this?
Mm-hmm. Vaguely.
I suppose that's one of those old wives' remedies, but anyhow, because that's the kind of book I read of it.
Mm-hmm. One of the wonderful things about our brain is that if we think it should help, it often will help. A sister-in-law of mine once, this is years ago, when they still had streetcars in Minneapolis, she loved to go downtown, but she'd get sick on the streetcar for the same reason, part of that and the eyes going will make you sick too. It's overstimulation of this whole system. She loved to go downtown. She didn't want to get sick. So as soon as she stepped on the streetcar, she'd take her medication, and she'd feel fine all the way home. Mother Sills pills or something, remember what? Something in that order. It did have some a little effective medication in it, but she got home before the medication had time to work. Medication doesn't work immediately. But it kept her from getting sick.
Ralph, are you familiar with the patch behind the ear? That's the newest thing.
No, tell us about it.
It's a little round patch behind the ear. You have to get it on the doctor's prescription. And you stick it back there, and I think it's good for 24 hours, and they say it works beautifully.
You know what is in the patch? There are several there. Some of you may be acquainted with the nitro patch for heart disease. A number of medications, preparations can go right through the skin. Most of them can't, but a number can. And I suppose this is the same way. You put the material in, scopolamine sounds logical, into a carrier, an oil or, I'm not sure, just but a, sort of an oily substance, something that will go through the skin anyway, and is picked up and then brought to you in a nice, even manner throughout, like the nitro should work. That's about 24 hours, isn't it, for the patch? And I suppose it's the same way for using the scope. And again, if it works, that's excellent. Scopolamine can also give some interesting side effects. But one of them is you get a dry mouth, and most of the things that will help this will give you a dry mouth. For a few people, it will give you visions. Any of you remember the twilight sleep for deliveries? A number of you remember that. And I used it back, it says something about how long ago I did deliveries. And some of the ladies had told me about things they saw on the windowsill that obviously weren't there, flowers and so on. Thought it was really nice that somebody would be so kind as to bring in flowers to the delivery room. This kind of thing. These are side effects. But if it works, and the best thing to do is to ask your own physician about it, or for some of the things, you can ask your pharmacy. And they'll tell you what is available. Going to the problems that you have with hearing, one of the more common and one of the more easily cured things is just plain wax in the ear. The wax is obviously there to protect the skin of the ear. We have oil all over our skin, but it's more oily than waxy. But in the ear it is. And if the wax there is thicker, it won't run out. I had a lot of trouble with that. Every 3 to 6 months, I get death on one ear or the other ear. Usually only one at a time. And then I fuss and fume and, well, I haven't got time to clean it out right now. And, you know, after 2 or 3 days, I've learned at least that I can do it after 2 or 3 days. I put in some ear drops that helps dissolve the wax so that it becomes thinner, then have to wash it out. And it's remarkable how the hearing has come back. One time, it was about 5, 6 years ago, I guess, it was in solid. And I thought sure that I was losing my hearing because it acted gradually, and I went to the otologist, and he sort of grinned and had his nurse wash off my ear, and my hearing was perfect after that, for another 3 months. But it's something that I think we should all be very aware of. When you become deaf on one ear, suddenly or sometimes gradually, be sure that it isn't just wax, because it's something which we shouldn't have to put up with. And if we go to, you know, if it's wax, I think I would first, before I would just clean it out, I would go to an otologist or your general practitioner, have them look at it. And it's sure easy to tell, because it's just all stuffed up. And look and see if he can see the drum or not. And then after he has seen that, yes, that is the problem, and it's not that you have a hole in your drum, because that would make it, you wouldn't like to do your own cleaning if you got a hole in the drum and can put in on clean water, and any time you put water through your ear, it's not going to be sterile into this inner ear, the middle ear. So do that. Then after that, you can go ahead and you can wash your ears out yourself. As I say, I need to do it every 3 to 6 months. And if I were smart, I would do it before I get deaf. Any of you notice what?
Aren't we all have to dig at our ears rather than wash them out?
Okay, what is the problem with that?
You're apt to get into trouble.
Why?
Well, the tissue is delicate when you're poking at something that you have no right poking at.
And what do you suppose would be the most likely thing that you would injure?
Ear drum.
Yeah. And that is not good. On the other hand, it's so tender that most of us are not going to actually, if we go gradually, we're not going to injure it. But what is it? Don't put anything smaller than your elbow in your ear. It's a very good idea. You could use these Q-tips, yeah. But again, if I try that, and I do, I try using the Q-tips, and what I usually do is merely mess the wax around so that if it weren't completely closed before, it is after I get through. But Q-tips don't really work for wax in the ears. Any other questions or additions?
What is an ear syringe when you talk about maybe trying a little preliminary cleaning? Is an ear syringe an accessory that you buy and use after you put some sterile water in there?
Yeah, after what I do, and this is Maria, I guess this I could say would be a good medical suggestion as well as my personal experience. The pharmacy can tell you what they have at that time. They have, and it's usually a peroxide, I think, of some type that will help dissolve the wax, make it softer. You put that in, you lay your head around on the side, you get your spouse to put it in, 3 to 5 drops or something on that order. You play around with your ears so you're sure they get it down into where it works, and you can hear a sizzle sometimes. You lie there for 3 to 5 minutes, something like that is what it says. Then you take a soft rubber ear syringe. It's just an ordinary syringe, rubber syringe, with a soft rubber tip rather than a hard tip on it, because again, coming into the ear, you want to be careful of that. Then you wash it out with it. So it's rather a simple thing. And right afterwards, it's liable to be worse than when you started because you got water in there. But that comes out in a few hours. Or you can use air in there and suck it out and so on.
Where does this wax form?
In the skin.
Inside or the outside?
Inside. Well, it's outside in the sense that it's on the skin. The skin is outside.
Okay.
but it's inside as far as on the inside of the canal, the auditory, the meatus, the auditory canal here. Okay, you come down to your eardrum. You can have problems with, well, it's particularly children have trouble with infections back here. You know what they do now to try and relieve the infections? The continuous infections. I suppose some of you have grandchildren.
Little tube, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Teflon tubes, small Teflon tubes, I think it is. You used to have to reach in and through a funnel and open that lens, the ear, because there was infection in here. And of course, the infection doesn't do these bones any good. If they're infected enough, they'll get hardened, and then you have a great loss of hearing. One of the reasons that children have trouble with their ears a lot is that there is adenoid tissue or lymph tissue in this area of the throat. And they get a cold or tonsillitis that tends to close off this tube and it doesn't drain. That's one of the advantages of putting in the tubes. It allows it to drain, equalize the pressure, and so on. Anytime you have pressure and you have bacteria, you're almost always going to get an infection. So what you want to do with the tubes is to try and equalize that pressure.
They actually go through the eardrum most of the time, or what?
Yeah. And eventually, the tubes drop out. The body is pretty good at throwing out foreign material. Even when you want it to stay in, well, it can push it out. So eventually they push out.
What's the difference between having a hole in the eardrum made by the doctor, or having a hole, if it were there naturally, it would be bad, but if he puts it in, it's okay?
You pay more for the doctor doing it. I suppose the advantage is that if you have an infected ear and it ruptures through and it is still infected for some time, you're liable to have a much larger hole than when my colleagues just lance it. And I think that'd be the main difference. It's in the right place and that it's the right size.
That's not the same as a perforated eardrum, then?
Yeah.
It
is. And that's what you do. And it does seem strange that you go pay good money to have the thing perforated when you don't want it perforated otherwise. But you can see why it's being done. It's being equalized, and of course when it ruptures and pus comes out of it, you're doing the same thing as when the physician does it, only he does it earlier. He puts it in the right place, and hopefully it's a small one that will heal right back over again. Now you slip in the tubes, and again you wonder about it, but it's to keep the pressure down. Okay, if you have a perforated eardrum and not have much left of the drum, it's not going to vibrate like you'd expect. So you lose quite a bit of the amplification that you would get ordinarily, which is translated into deafness.
Where does water stay? When you get water in your ears and it won't come out, where's that?
Actually, it usually stays right here, because it's a, you know, swimming, you like swimming. It's a small opening and just doesn't like to pour out. It's like, sometimes if you have water in a tube, it just doesn't want to, especially if the tube is closed off, it doesn't want to pour out. So it takes a while, sometimes almost 24 hours, to leak out. The problems you can get into, well, here, there is a a disease, a couple of diseases, in which these bones, ankylose, become hard, no longer can move. And it can really put a lot of wreck your hearing. I think Barbara Lee has the same, has that problem, that something genetically, I believe she said, that at a certain age they start to ossify, which is merely meaning they form bone in between, and the ear just will not conduct the sound, not change the sound into mechanical motion. And there can be very serious. One of the things that is done for some types of this is to get in with a microscope and loosen them up. But you can imagine how really delicate and difficult that would be, to reach in and polish off the bones so that they can be moved again. It's miraculous for those who have that type, and can be done when it is done. Then we get back to this membrane, which changes the sound, the mechanical movement, into nerve impulses. If you haven't got that, you ain't got nothing. Well, there's an interesting muscle in here too, a very small muscle, but very interesting, which I've forgotten now exactly where, but I believe it is attached to some of these bones that can tighten and loosen to allow you to hear more acutely or to sort of damp it down, like putting a plug in your ear. And it's very handy for hearing loud noises, like popular bands. Many of you have had to chaperone a dance. You know what it's like to have these tremendous high levels of sound. Can be very dangerous, in fact. That is the most common one right now. Another one that used to be the Boilermakers. And they used to have, it used to be one part of this, the part that would, high notes probably, with the Boilermakers, that would just wear out this part, because it's too high. It's painful, it's too high. Around our part of the country, it's the mill workers with their saws that get it. You'll see the airport people, the mechanics who lead the plane in, have earmuffs. And that's a very important part, to cut down the amount of noise that comes in, because it wrecks this part of the membrane. And for us, we probably aren't in that kind of a situation anymore, but if we do, be sure and put on, I mean, if they offer you the earmuffs, the sound reducers, by all means use them. But we didn't in the old days, and maybe some of us have holes in, if we measured our hearing, we'd find that in this one spot we practically can't hear at all. And it makes a lot of difference in the way we can understand people if there are holes in our hearing. So for prevention, keep below certain sound levels.
Is there any danger using swimming earplugs at night or sleeping to avoid noise pollution, as I call it?
Someone sounded really smart to me. Somebody was objecting to it, and I can't remember the reasons. I think that, you know, if, okay, there's a fire and you don't hear the alarm, any danger. That is the one problem, as I remember it, is that you also become unaware of any danger that's coming.
Well, I was wondering, if some of them are quite long, sort of longish, and they're rather uncomfortable at times.
Well, if they're uncomfortable.
Harmfulness in it.
If they're uncomfortable, one shouldn't use it. And I suppose that some of them could be long enough to reach down and touch the diaphragm. You're not going to probably wear them, though, because that's awfully uncomfortable. One interesting thing, have you ever noticed that when you did dig, and now don't tell your doctor that you did, when you dug back down in the, you started coughing? That's fascinating, because one little section of the skin in here is connected to the same, goes up to the brain and connects with the same nerve that comes from your throat, from your trachea. And so when a little spot in here is stimulated, it makes you cough, because your brain reads it as coming from your chest.
What happens inside your ear when you have tinnitus?
Okay. I wish I could really tell you what happens, because I'd be lecturing to all the big boys. Undoubtedly, it must be in this area that the nerves are being stimulated. And then your brain can't tell the difference. After all it knows is that the end of this nerve, the eighth nerve that comes into your brain, has been stimulated. If you feel around your elbow, you can jump pretty good by rolling your crazy bone, which is a nerve. Your ulnar nerve, or your ulnar on that side, radial on the other. As far as the brain is concerned, it's these fingers that are being stimulated. And if you do the same thing to the nerve in the ear, your brain is going to read it as noise. Remember, if you rub your eyes, you can see all these pretty pictures? The brain reads any kind of stimulation of the eye as light. Or, in fact, if you fall down and hit your head and stimulate the part of the brain that is receiving this, you can see light also. Because it's these nerve stimulations, and the brain can't tell what's at the other end. It says ordinarily it's the eye, and anything coming from that's going to be light. If you're hitting the head and you see stars, that's what's happening. And tinnitus, it must be in the same manner that this is being stimulated. Now, most of us have, at our age, are going to have some tinnitus. Ordinarily you don't hear it, but when everything gets quiet, I mean everything should be quiet, then you can hear it. Does that make sense? And because of that, there isn't so much you can do about it. Probably again, overstimulation of this inner ear part is going to give you trouble with the tinnitus too, because this has been damaged. Damaged nerve endings tend to give you false signals. But one of the things I wanted to get at was, what about amplification? That's the fancy word for a hearing aid, is amplification. I was reading up on this, believe it or not, for this lecture, and one of the things that they suggested was you should be examined by an otolaryngologist or a specialist in the ear to see that you have, first of all, it's because, supposing we're getting deaf, can't hear things as well as people just don't talk up like they used to. So, and then you get there's a lot of noise at night. You can't quite figure out why in the world there should be that much noise at night. OK, Okay, you should go to the ear specialist, have them look and see that there isn't a disease present, that your ear isn't full of wax, that it isn't infected. And if some of this happens suddenly, then by all means do it. Because if something's been going on gradually for a long time, it means something entirely different from it that happens overnight or in a week or something. Anyway, go see the ear specialist to see that you don't have a disease which should be stopped or which could be cured. Then you would probably, next, if that's true, he would probably send you, or probably right in his office, he has somebody who could check and see what you are actually hearing. Are you hearing, I knew I was deaf, but after he cleaned my ears out, however, and he ran the test on it, found that my hearing, they make a fancy chart out of it, was perfectly normal. Okay. If you find that your ear, the hearing has a chart, a curve that looks, has one pattern, then they say, aha, this type of amplification would help you. If you have another pattern, unfortunately, the amplification probably won't do you any good, which can save you $1,000 if they know that it won't do you any good. And if it will, it may put you back in business of hearing well. So it's quite worthwhile having these exams to see whether you need it, whether it would be a benefit to you. Now, I was after Paul to tell us Paul has amplification, and I would like to have him tell his experience. I haven't heard this yet, so this is a little dangerous to do this. Would you tell us about how you decided to have amplification? How you learned to make use of it? Was it magic? Did you have to have two or three? What does it cost to have one?
Well, I began to notice some years ago that I wasn't hearing very well, especially when I was in a group. I was doing quite well when I was talking one-on-one to individuals, but when I got in a group, we invited 6 or 8 people over for an evening or something, I found that it was difficult for me to understand what people were saying, especially if 2 or 3 people were talking at the same time or there was some background noise. And I went through that stage of grumbling that people didn't speak up the way they used to, and so on. And especially some of the young people who have a tendency not to quite speak as loudly anyway, so I went through that. My wife had some hearing problems, and she urged me to go and see the doctor, and I stalled it off for about a year, I think. But finally, I went to see an ear doctor, and he diagnosed my hearing as a loss of the high range of hearing. And he sent me to a specialist who tested ears and said that especially I had lost the hearing of the higher notes. And by the way, I have been cutting wood for about 10 years. We have a wood lot and we heat with wood. And I have 2 or 3 chainsaws. And the doctor asked me what I had been doing, and among the other things, I mentioned that I had been using a chainsaw, and he said, do you use ear coverings? And I said, no, I hadn't really thought about that. And he said, well, it's possible that this may have been one of the factors that led to your diminished hearing.
Because of that particular loss.
Yeah, chainsaw is a very loud machine, and now, when I use the chainsaw, I cover my ears, but it's too late, unfortunately. Well, he sent me to another person who did testing, and between the two of them, they recommended that I get a hearing aid. I wasn't very happy about that. This is the hearing aid. It's just a little, very small device that fits in the ear, and it has a little on and off clicker here. And I can turn it up until it whistles, and then I know it's too loud, so I turn it down a little bit. But this has helped me just immeasurably. It isn't good in a restaurant where you've got clinking of dishes and silverware and people talking and so on. I hate to use it, and I don't use it much up when we're having lunch up here in the mess hall. It's excellent, however, for the kind of thing that I was doing leading a group, because when you people were asking questions and discussing, I couldn't really have led this group without the help of this this hearing aid device. It's been really helpful. I don't use it all the time. I use it in special situations like this, where it's helpful. At home, I very seldom use it, because my wife and I speak up to each other, and we don't need it. When I bought this about 3 years ago, the total cost was about $350. I think they've gone up now to 400 and some, or possibly even 500. Yeah. I haven't checked it lately. I would believe.
That, excuse me, is that for one or two?
For one. Recently, the thing didn't work. I couldn't get it to turn on, and there was no sound, so I brought it back to the company, and they said they could certainly recondition it and fix it, but they had a flat fee of $71. So if you're hearing it quits, you bring it to your company, at least the one I went to, which was the Telex, Benson Optical, which I think...
Is that the name of the...
Telex is the name of the machine, T-E-L-E-X. That's just one brand, but it was a flat fee of $71 to have it repaired. Now that carries a 6 month guarantee. If it goes out again in 6 months, they'll fix it free. But if it's over 6 months, then if it goes out, it's another $71. So it's not cheap. And then you have to buy batteries, of course. And I can't remember the price of the batteries.
How many do you have to have a year?
Not too many. Now, I've worn it consistently this week, and I've been wearing, using one battery all week. Well, the 2 weeks. I've been here almost 2 weeks now. I've used only one battery. I think I buy three or four packs of batteries a year, and I think they run $6-$7 each a pack. So I suppose it must be around $30-$40 a year for batteries.
It's deductible.
Pardon?
It's deductible.
Deductible.
If we only made enough money to make it worthwhile to deduct it.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. But that's about it. Does anyone have any questions about hearing aids?
Well, I can't see the size of yours, but is it anything like President Reagan's, that the cameraman had such a hard time zooming in on it to catch it when he was debating?
I didn't hear you. I didn't have it on. Say it again.
Well, President Reagan had such a small hearing aid that the photographer had a little trouble getting a picture of it when they were on the, when he was debating.
Oh. Well, President Reagan doesn't like to admit that he's getting older or anything, so he... I'm sure he got the smallest possible hearing. This one, I think, is quite evident when you look at it, but most people don't really notice it.
Did you have to have a mold made?
Yes, I had to have a mold made, and that was part of the cost. So, but they took a wax impression of the ear first, and then it took about 3 or 4 weeks, I think, before the hearing aid was delivered.
Did it take you a while to to learn to use it.
Yes, I didn't like it at first. I had a difficult time because I tried to wear it in a number of different places and it was inappropriate, like in a restaurant or if I get in a group, like immediately following this session, you people will get up and start talking to each other. And then somebody will come up to me in the middle of all of this and say, oh, I wanted to discuss this with you. And I'll say, what was that you said? Because there's so much talking, background talking, that I found it inappropriate in a group where there's a lot of discussion. It took me quite a while, really, to adjust to using it. I'd say it took me the first 6 months for me to become adjusted to it so I was comfortable with it.
How about music?
Music, music comes through real well. I'm just thrilled with it because in the years before I got the hearing aid, I was listening to music, but I wasn't getting the higher
right.
notes. And when I got this hearing aid and I sat down and listened to music, suddenly it just was glorious because I could hear the soaring high notes that I hadn't heard for quite a number of years. Really helpful.
You say you take yours out quite often. Have you ever, what do you do with it? Stick it in your
pocket? I have a little leather case that's just like this. It opens up just by squeezing it.
Then you haven't lost it.
And I just drop it in there. No, I haven't lost it. I just drop it in and it's flat enough so I just keep it in my breast pocket. And there's no problem with that.
I think all of us senior citizens ought to have breast pockets in all of our shirts.
Right. One on each side, one for glasses and one for...
Exactly. Have any of the rest of you, what was your experience with it? We're seeing your aid.
That's the right one. I've got the left one on. My hearing loss was due to perforated eardrums about 50 years ago, and nothing was done about them at the time. I was living in the hospital, and I couldn't get a doctor. They were all at the Indiana basketball tournament, but they perforated, and as I said, nothing was done about it. But I have a problem with going to these people that test your ears. Well, how do you know that what they test is, their test is accurate? If they would give you several choices of hearing aids. Now, I use mine for a speaker, but in the crowd, it's murder. Absolute murder. The narthex of the church can just drive me crazy. But I'm not sure that I've got the right hearing aids, and the two of them cost me $1,200. But I was really, I guess I was upset at the time, and I wanted to get hearing aids, and you know, you think about it, and when you finally get to it, well, then you, I don't know, I was making a decision by myself, and I'm not sure that it was the right one, but I do use these, I use one of them more than two of them, but they recommend now that you have two. Your hearing is more accurate.
She just alluded to, I think, a real problem that maybe you should discuss a little bit is how do you tell the good guys from the bad guys in this business? There's an awful lot of bad guys in the business.
With the testing.
Yes. Not only the testing, but going for the analysis, getting the right kind of a hearing aid. How do you tell the good ones from the bad?
Well, you have a choice of stuff, but they'll say, well, we have to make a mold for each different one. But now I do know that now there's some places that let you try them for a month or something like that. And if that one doesn't do the job, then you can try another kind. But I feel that's what I should have had in the first place.
Well, in other words, we really should get some guidance to who to go to first, who can give us recommendations, the right kind of guys to go to. This is what the recommendations and of the society, the hearing societies, just as you said, first to probably an otolaryngologist.
don't know if I can even spell it. But
now, would that be an MD type? Or
that MD type, to see about if you do have infection. Have him recommend, what is an audiometrist, is it?
Yeah. Audiologist.
Etc. Who should be, I suppose some states will license, but should have the degree which goes with whatever it is. Just as you want a licensed plumber, why you need a licensed person here. Because I've heard of too many people who spent $1,000, $2,000, and not have satisfaction. It really doesn't help much to have the hearing aid in the dresser drawer. Did you have any more
suggestions? Yeah, I wanted to say on that, I don't think I would go directly to a hearing aid specialist.
No.
I mean, a hearing aid company. I went to a doctor, a medical doctor, an otolaryngologist. A hearing doctor. And he could hear quite well. But he recommended that I go to an audiologist, and the audiologist recommended the type of hearing aid I should have and recommended the kind of company I should go to. And I think he gave me two or three choices of company. Now, the reason I like that is that I think these three people keep each other in line, you know. I couldn't believe that they were all in cahoots with each other or anything, because the medical doctor was certainly a reputable person. I checked him out. So I think there you are assured of at least the best kind of care. When you go directly to a hearing aid specialist, I think you may be subject to persons who are maybe unscrupulous or haven't really the skills to diagnose it properly and so on.
They're businessmen.
Yeah.
And a salesman. I remember overhearing a group of salesmen saying, well, you know, you couldn't get too sympathetic. I mean, this guy was a great salesman, but he was too sympathetic. Yes?
You see some people who have on their glasses, on their earlobes here. And I'm wondering which kind is the best.
Anybody have an answer to which kind is the best? Yes?
I can make a comment. My wife isn't here. She didn't come to this session today. But this is at least one aspect to it. She is deaf on one ear, almost completely. And she has a hearing aid in her glasses, and it's wired up so that the sound, well, I'm not sure how it comes in one side, but it sounds as though it's coming in the other side. It used to be that if I sat next to her deaf ear, she'd have to turn all the way around so I could hear what she was saying, like if we were in a theater or something. Sometimes people thought we were kissing each other. which isn't so bad, but, you know, in public and all. But this does bring the sound around for her so that when you sit on that side, it does bring the sound across. Now, that's one reason for having it in glasses. I don't know if I explained that carefully enough.
And this is one of the reasons that you go to an audiologist. I think it has the word cross in it, because obviously the microphone is on one side of the glasses and the amplification is on the other side.
If you notice you're getting sort of deaf, is it better to go right away, or can you wait? When is it easier to get used to it?
Not having had it, I can't answer. Can anybody give me some of their personal experience on that? Whether you should go immediately or you should wait around, like most of us will do anyway. Anybody say from their experience? Would you, Paul, would you think that you would have enjoyed life more if you had gone earlier?
Yes, I do. there was a period of several years where I wasn't hearing well, and I was getting more irritable about the fact that people weren't speaking up. I wasn't enjoying music as much, and so on. I wish I'd gone a little earlier.